This is Gospel and Life. Today, Tim Keller is looking at the attributes of God through his series titled, To Know the Living God. After listening, we'd appreciate it if you take a moment to rate and review the podcast. Your response helps others discover and experience the life-giving truth and grace of the gospel, because the gospel changes everything. Now, here's Dr. Keller.
Tonight's scripture is from the book of Psalm, chapter 139, verses 1 through 24. O Lord, you have searched me, and you know me. You know when I sit and when I rise. You perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down. You are familiar with all my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, you know it completely, O Lord. You hem me in, behind and before. You have laid your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too lofty for me to attain. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me. Your right hand will hold me fast. If I say, surely the darkness will hide me, and the light will become night around me, even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like the day, for darkness is as light to you. For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place. When I was woven together in the depths of the earth, your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. How precious to me are your thoughts, O God! How vast is the sum of them! Were I to count them, they would outnumber the grains of sand. When I awake, I am still with you. If only you would slay the wicked, O God! Away from me, you bloodthirsty men! They speak of you with evil intent. Your adversaries misuse your name. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord, and abhor those who rise up against you? I have nothing but hatred for them. I count them my enemies. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there is any offensive way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. This is the word of the Lord.
Each week we're taking a look at another one of the characteristics of God according to the Bible. Attributes, they're called. And this week we begin looking at what the theologians call the incommunicable attributes, as opposed to the communicable attributes. And I love that term, those terms, because it's a way of getting across the fact that some of God's attributes are communicable. When he's holy, he's loving, he's wise, you can catch those. You can catch his attributes, but not all of them. Some attributes belong to him and him alone. And that's the ones we're looking at tonight, or starting to look at tonight. We call them the omni-attributes. He's omniscient. He knows everything. He's omnipotent. He's got all power. And he's omnipresent. He's everywhere. Now, omniscience and omnipotence and omnipresence are attributes that we'll never get. Now, I know that parents tried to have them with regard to their children. It really doesn't work, and does get a lot of resentment. But in general, according to the theologians, these are three attributes that only God has. And all three of them are mentioned in this particular passage, though the main point of Psalm 139, it's a great psalm, is that he's ever-present. He's present everywhere. We can't get around him. His presence, you can't get away from him. His presence is our inescapable environment. There's three things the text tells us about the presence of God. And only if you see how all three of them can be true, or ask how could they all be true, does the psalm really yield its message. And those three things are: God's presence is an inescapable fact, his presence is a radical threat, and his presence is a transforming joy. First, his presence is an inescapable fact. The first three stanzas, 1 to 6, 7 to 12, 13 to 18, it's so nicely laid out, show how God surrounds us. In verses 1 to 6, his knowledge surrounds us. If you look how the poet, how David, the poet, does it, he gets it across. In verse, the first part of verse 2 and the first part of verse 3, there's polarities, and it says that God knows us whether we're sleeping or active, whether we're home or traveling. The second part of verse 2 and 3 talk about he perceives my thoughts. Verse 2, he's familiar with all my ways, which is my behavior. Verse 3, so he knows everything on the inside and knows everything on the outside. See, when you and I look at things, we can see the outside, but it's very hard to discern the thoughts. Or we can see people when they're near, but it's very hard to tell what they're doing when they're far away. But not God. He's all-knowing. He's omniscient. And then in verse 4, it says, before a word is on my tongue, you know it completely. David goes so far as not just to say, well, of course, before I do something, before I think something, before I say something, even before I know I'm going to do it, you know it. But he goes further and says, you know it completely. And it's a way of getting across what we talked about last week. And here's where the attributes of God intersect and link. They do. Remember how last week we said that if you want to understand how God relates to time, you could imagine time as a river with a lot of bends in it. And there's boats on the river, and the boats can't see each other because this boat's in the present, this boat's in your past, this boat's in the future. They're different places in time. But imagine that there's a mountaintop, and then whoever's on the top of the mountain can see the whole river so that all the boats are present to the person at the top of the mountain. That's how God relates to time. That when God looks at time, he sees all of it at once. And you and I have a tendency to fall into the mistake of saying, well, God can foresee the future. That's talking as if he's trapped in the present with you, but he's not. God's not in the present. All moments are present to God. All moments are equally related to God. He sees it all happening at once. And what that means is only he knows who you are, because he sees your past, present, and future. He sees everything. You can only ever see a little slice of yourself. There's that place at the end of the Lord of the Rings where one of the characters, who's a king, lays himself down in the tomb of the kings to die. And he says goodbye to everyone. He says goodbye to his wife. And then he dies. And there's these great lines where it says, and everyone who looked upon him at that moment did so in wonder. For the grace of his youth, the valor of his manhood, and the wisdom and majesty of his age were all blended together. Long there he lay, a vision of the splendor of the kings of men in glory undimmed before the breaking of the world. At that moment, the text says, the grace of his youth, the valor of his manhood, the wisdom and majesty of his age were all put together. See, that's how God sees. God sees everything, but you only ever see a little slice. You see yourself as young. You see yourself as old. You see yourself as whatever, but he sees all of you, and therefore only God knows who you are. God knows everything. You infinitely more than you know yourself. And so we're surrounded by God's knowledge, his omniscience. But then, next stanza, verses 7 to 12, talks about how we're surrounded by his presence. Again, the poet gives you polarities to get across the comprehensiveness of this. So in verse 8, it says, if I go to the heavens, that's up in the stars, or if I make my bed in the depths, and that's the word Sheol, which is the word for the place of the dead, the depths of the earth, where you, the grave where you put dead people. If I go all the way to the heavens, the stars, if I go all the way down to the depths of the earth, you're there. You're there. You're there. And then he says, if I go to the wings of the dawn, that's utter east, where the sun's coming up. Or if I go on the far side of the sea, and don't forget, Israel, the Mediterranean was to the west of it, and so the far side of the sea is utter west. If I go as far east as I can possibly go, as far west, you're there, you're there, you're everywhere. Then it says, very important, verse 7, and we'll get back to this in just one second. Where can I flee from your presence? Now, this is the word for face. The Hebrew, whenever you see the word in the Old Testament, the word presence, it's actually Hebrew, the Hebrew word for face, God's face, panim. And what this is saying is everywhere he goes, there's God's face. And this gets across something that I think has always amazed me, but this is what the theologians will tell you. You mustn't think that when we say God fills everywhere, God is everywhere, that he fills space like a gas. See, if I brought in a canister of gas, a particular kind of gas, and I opened it, and it would go out, it would fill the room, Yes, it would be everywhere, you might say, but basically what's happening is you're extending the molecules. So there's some of them, some of the gases there, some of the gases there, some of the gases there. That's not what we mean when we say God is everywhere, that he's stretched out or extended. Oh, no. All of him is everywhere. The theologians say God is repletively present. He's completely present at every point in space. So not only are we learning here that God is present to every point in time, but God is present in every point in space. No wonder the psalmist is starting to just to say, how wondrous is this? How amazing is this? So first of all, we're surrounded by his knowledge. Secondly, we're surrounded by his presence. And then thirdly, we're surrounded by his power, because verses 13 to 18 talk about that. And again, it talks about, for example, in 13, you created my inner being. That's my soul. And you knit me together in my mother's womb. That's my body. So it's saying both your body and your soul are created by God, upheld by God. But then, if you read through the rest of it, down to verse 16, it says, and all the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. All the days ordained for me. All of your days are ordained. He not only creates, ordains, sustains, and upholds your body and soul, keeping you together at every second, keeping your molecules together. But he also creates, sustains, ordains, and sustains your history. And are you figuring out what he's saying here? Because at the one end of human life is conception. He says, in my mother's womb, you knew me. You were knitting me together. But at the other end, what about the other end? All my days, at the very end of your life, when you're old and you feel like, what am I even here for? It's ordained. Every single day that you're on earth is ordained. There's a plan. There's a reason. Now, here's what he's saying. From conception to the last breath, God is in charge. He created you. He ordained. He sustains. He upholds. See, his power overshadows absolutely every second of your life. And now, look, let's talk about the implications. Here's an ethical implication to this doctrine of God's presence and power being there. Not only up here and down here and over there, but in here and out here, and from the very beginning of conception all the way to the very end. You see the comprehensiveness of this? Here's one of the implications of the presence of God. This is the reason why everybody over the centuries who's taken this doctrine of God seriously, from the early Christians to the ancient Jews, have always said both abortion and active euthanasia are wrong. Why? Because you're putting yourself in the place of God. God's in charge of those parts of life. You see, life in the very, very beginning in the womb and life at the very, very end when you're really old, that life is fragile and it's inconvenient. And we might say, let's do something about it. But that's a violation, according to the Bible, of the glory and rights of God. Now, by the way, would you please not listen to this politically? This was written before the culture wars. This is not about politics. This is about the doctrine of God. And therefore, you are sitting in the throne of God if you do something about life in the womb, because, you know, John the Baptist and Jeremiah were called by God and filled with the Spirit in the mother's womb. When you're in the mother's womb, you're you. You're the image of God. But at the other end, when you feel absolutely useless and you feel like, what am I even here for? Why not end it all? That's not your place. All your days are ordained. You're still under the shadow of God and his presence and his power. So, point one, God's presence is an inescapable fact to every aspect of life, every dimension of life. Point one. But now, point two. David is not just a theologian giving us facts, is he? He is a poet telling us about how his heart responds to those facts. And therefore, we see here that the presence of God is not just an inescapable fact, but for the human heart, it's a radical threat. David actually goes through a journey, and there's at least four stages in the journey. If you look carefully, his attitude runs a gamut. His attitude toward this inescapable God, God everywhere, God seeing me, God all the way, God involved in absolutely every fiber of my being and life and history. What are those four? four stages. Here's the first one. The first part, the first stage, is up here when he says in verse 6, such knowledge is too wonderful for me. Now, you know, that looks positive. In English, it comes across as a kind of a positive, but it's not. Literally, it says, too wonderful from me is this knowledge. It's a man who is saying, this is too much for me. This is beyond me. I don't get it. This is too amazing. It's not a positive. It's like I'm reeling. My circuits are you know, blowing. And the reason for it is verse 5. You hem me in. You see, this all-present God, this all-powerful God, this all-knowing God, when you start to realize that, it starts to feel like a blanket you're smothering under. You're suffocating underneath it. And that's what he begins to do. And then very quickly, he slides from 5 and 6, which is, I'm kind of threatened by this, and I feel like you're hemming me in, I feel smothered, to verse 7, when it says, where can I go from your spirit, and where can I flee from your presence? And with that second question, where can I flee from your presence, is out and out flight. It's rebellion. It's the same two Hebrew words that describe what Jonah did in the very beginning of the book of Jonah. Where can I flee from your presence, from your face? How can I get away from your face? Because in the very beginning of the book of Jonah, some of you know, Jonah the prophet was told, go to Nineveh and preach the word to Nineveh. And because Jonah both hated and feared the Ninevites, instead of going that way, he went that way. He got on a ship and went as far away as he could. And it says, Jonah fled from the presence of the Lord. Same words, out and out rebellion. And so David's moved from being, you know, kind of like just sort of suffocating from the idea of God everywhere to just saying, let me away. Let me get away. Let me out of here. Now, David was an ancient man. And ancient men and women did not expect to live their lives just the way they wanted to live their lives. Most of them knew that their tribe, their family was going to dictate a lot of how they lived. And yet even David can hardly stand the idea of a God who's completely all-powerful, all-knowing, all-present God. And if he can't stand it, what about us? Because let me tell you who we are. Modern people have taken a perfectly great idea, and that is democratic political self-determination. Democratic political self-determination. We should be able to choose our own governments, choose our own leaders. Democratic political self-determination, a great idea. And we have elevated it to an ultimate spiritual reality and the very meaning of life. We feel like unless I have to be me, I have to live my way, I have to live as I decide is right or wrong. And if I don't have the freedom to live as I want to live, my life is meaningless. That's how we are. That's what our culture tells us. And if that's your understanding of life, and it is our understanding of life here, the omni-God, the all-powerful, all-knowing, all-present God is a nightmare, an absolute nightmare. It's complete it just destroys that very idea. And that's the reason why, now we're going to get back to this in a few weeks because Jean-Paul Sartre's great book, Being and Nothingness, talks about a number of things we want to get back to under other headings, so I'll just briefly say this about it. Sartre said in Being and Nothingness, if there is a God, we can't be free. If there's a God who sees everything, then we're dehumanized. If there's a God who controls everything, that's unconscionable. And if we're free, then there's no God. And if there's a God, then we're not free, period. And that's the reason why, David, that's the reason why, Jonah, and that's the reason why so many of us we want to escape this all ever-present God. We don't want to be around. We don't want to believe he exists. Scott Peck, when I came to New York 22 years ago, everybody's reading Scott Peck books. Now I don't think anybody even knows who Scott Peck is, actually. But one of his books has enduring value, I think. It's called The People of the Lie. And in that book, he was a therapist, he talks about a therapy session he was having with a woman he calls Charlene, not obviously her real name. And Charlene was saying she is experiencing meaninglessness. I just don't know what to live for. I've got no desire to live. Now, from the intake interview, he remembered that she used to be very involved in church. In fact, she had been a Sunday school teacher. And so in the session, he said, well, you're pretty active in church. What does Christianity say about meaning in life? She looked at him, eyes narrowing, and said, I'm not a Christian anymore. I just believe in love, and I really don't know what the meaning of life is. Well, Scott Peck said, but couldn't your Christianity tell you anything about the meaning of life? What does Christianity say about the meaning of life? And she looked at him, and she rolled her eyes, and she said, we exist for the glory of God, she said in a monotone, flat monotone, sullenly repeating what she had learned by rote and was now extracted at gunpoint. Now, the idea was, she'd been told when she was little, the meaning of life is to live for the glory of God. So when he says, well, what does Christianity say is the meaning of life? We're supposed to live for the glory of God. You know, obviously very unhappy with, very sullen, very resentful. And he says, okay, does that help you at all? And then she exploded. And she says, I cannot do that, living for the glory. He says, I cannot do it. There's no room for me in that. That would be my death. I don't want to live for God. I will not live for God. I want to live for me. I want to live for myself. Jonah, David, Sartre, Charlene. Let me out of here. Where can I go? Why? Because then I can't be what I want to be. I want to live free. And of course, if the meaning of life is to live any way you want, then if there is a God like this, you can't live that way. And how do we get away? How do we get away? I mean, I don't know how David was trying to get away, but the way we try to get away, we don't believe in him. And we don't believe he's a God like that. But David goes from being really upset, feeling hemmed in and smothered, to outright, let me out of here. And then he changes again, and he experiences what even Sartre calls the ambivalence about trying to escape from God.
Success, true love, and the life you've always wanted. Many of us have made these good things into ultimate things. We put our faith in them when deep down we know that they cannot satisfy our longings. The truth is that we've made lesser gods of these good things, gods that can't give us what we really need. In his book, Counterfeit Gods, Dr. Keller shows us how a proper understanding of the Bible reveals the truth about societal ideals and our own hearts, and that there is only one God who can wholly satisfy our desires. Dr. Keller's book is our thank you for your gift to help Gospel and Life share the power of the gospel. So request your copy today at gospelandlife.com/give. That's gospelandlife.com/give. Now, here's Dr. Keller with the remainder of today's teaching.
You can see it in verses, if you read through verses 7 all the way through 10. See, when he first asks the questions, how do I get away from you? How do I get away from you? Then notice what he does. There's a series. If I go up here, you're still there. If I go down here, you're still there. If I go over here, you're still there. And then he says, and if I go over here, even there, you're right. Your hand will guide me, and your right hand will hold me fast. Now, what's that? Do you see that change in tone? Just like that? He says, I want to be free. I want to be free. And yet, if you're there, and everywhere I go, your right hand guides me. Your hand guides me, and your right hand holds me fast. A hand that guides so that you don't get lost. A hand that holds you so that you don't fall down. Sartre talks about this in his famous essay on, his lecture, actually, on existentialism he gave in 1946. You can find it all over the internet, by the way. It was kind of the signature lecture after World War II. And he said this was his philosophy. Listen carefully. He said, around 1880, the French professors said, God is a useless hypothesis. So we will do without it. But if we are to have a society, they said, it is essential that certain values should be taken seriously. There must be a priori values. Now, by the way, a priori means apart from experience, absolute moral values. So he says, we must believe in a priori existence ascribed to them, to be honest, not to lie, not to beat one's wife, to bring up children, and so forth. These values exist, although, of course, there is no God. However, Sartre says, the existentialist, on the contrary, finds it extremely embarrassing that God does not exist. For there disappears with God all possibility of finding anything good a priori. Dostoevsky once wrote, if God did not exist, everything would be permitted. And that, for the existentialist, is the starting point. Everything is indeed permitted if God does not exist, for all moral statements are now at the human level. All opinions are equal. And man, therefore, is in consequence forlorn, for he cannot find anything to depend upon, either within or outside. In other words, man is free. Man is freedom. That is what I mean when I say we are condemned to be free. Did you hear that? He's saying, if you want to be free, no hand to hold you, no hand to guide you, nothing inside yourself or outside of yourself to rely on. You can either, and see the ambivalence? David has it. I want to be free. I want to get away. I don't want to be hemmed in. And yet, I do want a hand to hold me. I do want a hand to guide me. And Sartre says, we want to be free. We want to be free. But if we are free, we have to realize no hand, no guidance, no moral values. Now, you know, Sartre got a lot of flack over the years because he could not live consistent with this idea. It is very, very clear at various points he was very moralistic in condemning certain kinds of behavior, which he thought were absolutely wrong. And people said, hey, what about that 1946 lecture? And what the Bible would say, he was trying to escape the inescapable. He was trying to get away because he didn't want to be hemmed in, and yet he still needed that hand. So you see, the presence of God is an inescapable fact, and yet it's also a radical threat. And this is our condition. The human condition is we can't live with God and we can't live without God. That's it. We're trying to get away. We're trying to escape from that which is inescapable. And by the middle of the psalm, we see that condition. But the psalm goes on. And point three, David eventually breaks through this sense of being threatened, this ambivalence, to seeing the presence of God as an absolute transforming joy. I think it starts in verse 11 and 12 when he says something pretty intriguing, though a little enigmatic. If I say, surely the darkness will hide me and the light will become night around me, even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like the day, for darkness is as light to you. Now, in the Psalms, what is darkness? It's always suffering, danger, the possibility of death, terrible disease. See? Darkness are times of absolute terror. And when you plunge into the dark, you feel like, I'm lost. But no, no. What if you have a God that you can't get rid of? What if you have a God that is always there? What if you have a God who's absolutely present, who's got you by the hand? Instead of that being a threat, wait a minute, that's wonderful. Because God can't lose me in the darkness. God can't lose me. For God, darkness is as light. And therefore, I'm safe. He's got me by the hand. And even my darkness will turn to light. And let's keep going. You get down to verse 17. It's intriguing. He says, how precious to me are your thoughts, O God. How vast is some of them. Precious. You know the word precious is just what you think it looks like. It's a word that usually has to do with diamonds and jewels and gold. And he's saying, now, the idea of your knowledge, the idea of your presence is rich to me. I'm not just ambivalent about it. It's rich to me. And then finally, verse 18, which as you can tell, you notice how the psalm is broken down beautifully into these stanzas. At the very end of this journey, as he's getting more and more excited about the presence of God, he's breaking through and seeing it as more and more transforming joy. Finally, he says, when I awake, verse 18, I am still with you. And that's the climax of the journey. And many commentators, especially people who are experts in Hebrew poetry, say there's something weird here. This is wrong. Why would this be the climax? See, back in the beginning of the psalm, it said that when I sleep or wake up, God's there. He's already said this. Even when I wake up, he's there. And why would this be the climax? Why would this be, you know, why would he build up to the place where he actually finally says, because God is ever present with me, even when I awake, he'll be there. Why would that be the climax if it's talking about waking up from sleep? It's probably not. And many commentators point out that David has another psalm, Psalm 17, at the very end, where he says this, "And I, in righteousness, will see your face. When I awake from death, I will be satisfied with seeing your form." You know what David's saying? David has moved away, so far away from being threatened by this God who's always around me. He says, I've got a God who is so impossible to lose, who's so with me, who is always present with me, who's got me by the hand and will never let me go. And this God is so present with me, and he's got me, he's gripped me so strongly that even if I die, he's going to be with me. There's the ultimate omnipresence. He's going to be with me through death, and he's going to wake me up. And in my resurrected body, I will see him. That's what it's talking about. With, you know what David's saying? If God's got you by the hand, even if you go into darkness, it'll become light. And even if you go into death, it'll become resurrection. In Mark chapter 5, Jesus was brought into the room of a little girl who was laying there dead. Dead. And they were all weeping, and he said, "Don't weep," and he sits down. She was in deep darkness, of course. She was making her bed in Sheol, but he took her by the hand, and he said, "Talitha kum." Talitha is a diminutive. It means little one, and it's a diminutive. It's the sort of thing that mothers or fathers would say to their children. Kum means awake or get up. It's the sort of thing you would say to a sleeping child on a sunny morning. You'd sit down and you'd say, "Honey, sweetheart, it's time to get up." Jesus Christ sits down alongside of a dead girl, takes her by the hand, and says, "Honey, it's time to get up." He reaches right through death and grabs her by the hand. Death, the most implacable, inexorable foe of the human race, he reaches right down through that and with a tug of his hand pulls her right up through it, almost to say, if I have you by the hand, even death is just a nice night's sleep. You see, this is what David is saying. He has me by the hand, even there, even in the darkness, anywhere I go. And if he has you by the hand, then even darkness will turn to light, and even death will turn to resurrection. When I awake, I am with you. There's an omnipresent God. Now, how did David do that? I would like you to look at your own heart and see that we all struggle with this idea of a God who's all around me. We find it smothering. We want to make our own decisions. We don't like being observed. We don't like to feel like we're totally accountable for everything. And at the same time, we want him. We want that hand. We want to trust him. We want to rest in him. We want these assurances. How did David do it? How did he go from the threat to finding the presence of God in absolute transforming joy? What did he do? Where did he get the assurance that God was absolutely for him? And I believe it or not, the answer is in that last section, verse 19 to 24, which is so weird. In fact, I must admit to you, the first two or three times when I was in Virginia, when I was a pastor of a church in Virginia, the first two or three times I ever preached on this, I left these last verses out. I just read up to verse 18 and then preached on it. I didn't want my people to read verses 19 to 24, and I didn't understand them. Okay, so sue me. You know, I had a preaching professor once said, you know, preach your certainties, not your doubts. So I didn't go there. But I want you to see that the secret to the whole psalm is there. Why? First of all, verse 23 and 24 is amazing. After all this time of wanting to get away, not wanting God to look in, feeling hemmed in, right? At the very end, he invites absolute scrutiny, asks God to come all the way in. He says, "Search me, O God, and know my heart. Know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there's any offense in me, any sin at all, and then lead me in the path everlasting." Now, I want to know how in the world David had the assurance that if the very presence of God came in and he looked at God straight in the eye and God looked at him, that he would have the assurance that God would still accept him and love him and lead him. David knew what Moses said. Oh Lord, let me see your glory. Let me see your face. And God said, it'll kill you. David knew that when the Ark of the Covenant, which was put in the Holy of Holies in the tabernacle, the place of God's presence, when he was bringing the Ark of the Covenant up to the tabernacle, one guy who was bringing the Ark up named Uzzah saw the Ark wobbling, was afraid it was going to fall, and he put his hand on it and he was killed immediately. David knows, see, one of the reasons we want to be away from the presence of God is not right, because we want to be free. And of course, we know that God's service is perfect freedom. But one of the reasons why we're afraid of the presence of God is warranted. He's holy. And we're not. You know, the fact that we want to live our own lives, even though he's created us, he has ordained us, he has sustained us, he keeps us alive every second, we want to live our own lives the way we want to live our own lives, that's sin. We have no right to our lives, and yet we do it. We take it. That's sin. And God is holy, and we're sinful. And if we actually were to get in the real presence of the face of God, we couldn't survive. David knew that. David knew that God said to Moses, you won't survive my presence. David saw what happened to Uzzah. He knew that. He didn't know Revelation 6:16. But he intuited it. You know what Revelation 6:16 says? If you were to actually see God face to face in your sin, you would say to the mountains, fall on me, and to the hills, cover me, and hide me from the face of the one who sits on the throne. If you actually saw God face to face, you would know, I need to be covered. I can't stand this. He sees me. He knows me. I know myself. I can't stand myself. That's what would happen. So how does David get that kind of assurance that the presence of God will not be a lethal heat, but will be cool, wonderful love? And then the other question is, why is it true that in the New Testament we're told never to say the things that David says right there? Did you see verses 19 to 22? What's he say? I hate those who hate you, O Lord. I abhor those who rise up against you. I have nothing but hatred for them. They are my enemies. And you know, the New Testament says we are never allowed to say that. We're supposed to love our enemies. We're supposed to do good to those who abuse us. We're supposed to pray for our enemies. What happened between David and you and me that the Bible now says you must never talk the way David talks right there? What happened? You know what happened. David's greater son, who died on a cross praying for his enemies, happened. And that is the answer to the riddles. That's how David could have this assurance, though he doesn't probably understand why, that the presence of God is not going to destroy him. That's the reason why we are not supposed to say the things that David said, because David's greater son died praying for his enemies. Listen, let's compare them quick. Jesus Christ died praying Psalm 22. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? And if you read the rest of Psalm 22, you know what it's all about? It's about distance. Psalm 22, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Why are you so far from the words of my groaning? Do not be so far from me. O Lord, be not afar off. The whole psalm is about a God who's far away. Here's David, and he can't lose the presence of God. He can't get far away from God. And here's David's greater son, Jesus Christ, and he can't find the presence of God. You know why? David knew that because God had him by the hand, even darkness would turn to light. But Jesus knew that because God had let go of his hand, that even the midday light was turning to darkness. And it was. He was plunged into darkness. David was knit together in his mother's womb. Jesus was torn apart on the cross. Why? Why did Jesus get the absence of God? Why did Jesus get torn away from God? Why did Jesus lose the Father's hand? He was getting what we deserve. See, we try to get away. We try to live our own lives. We try to escape the inescapable, and that's wrong. And what's the penalty? To get what we ask for. To just be, to be abandoned. And Jesus was abandoned. He lost the presence of God so that if you believe in Jesus, you have the presence of God forever. And he's got you by the hand, and he'll never let you go. Never. You know, friends, The doctrine of the presence of God, once you understand the gospel of Jesus Christ, becomes a transforming, though edgy, comfort. What do we mean by edgy? Well, there's still an edge to it, isn't there? He's always with you. He sees what you're doing. You shouldn't do that. You shouldn't say that. You should live consistently because he's there. There's an edge. But in the end, it's an infallible comfort because it doesn't matter how dark things are. It doesn't matter what you're going through. He's got you by the hand. And if some of you say, but everything's going wrong lately, yeah, well, maybe that's him actually making sure that you come back to him. He's pursuing you. He's not abandoning you. I can tell you something. The worst times in my life, whenever I thought he was abandoning me, I looked back on it and I said, no, he was pursuing me. In Jesus Christ, he will never let you go. He's got you by the hand. Even death will be just a nice night's sleep, and all of your darknesses will turn to light. There is no refuge from him. There's only refuge in him. Think about that. Let's pray. Our Father, we thank you that we try to escape you, but you pursue us. And in Jesus Christ, you surround us with your love. And you say, we'll never let you go. I'll never let you go. I pray, Father, that you would help us to be changed by a gospel understanding of the omnipresence, your omnipresence. I pray, Father, that we would have the circumspection and the assurance that comes from knowing that you're always with us. And we pray, Father, that you would help us to continue to grow in grace and in the likeness of Jesus Christ, in whose name we pray. Amen.
Thanks for listening to Gospel and Life. We pray that your knowledge of who God is continues to shape the way you look at yourself and the world around you. Please take a moment before you go to rate and review the podcast. When you do, you'll help others find this resource and discover God's grace through the gospel of Jesus, because the gospel truly changes everything. Thanks again for listening. This month's sermons were recorded in 2011. The sermons and talks you hear on the Gospel and Life podcast were preached from 1989 to 2017 while Dr. Keller was senior pastor at Redeemer Presbyterian Church.